Okay, this is a little thing I'm going to read to you in its entirety. I know it's pretty small, but this is an 11-year-old young man who wrote a letter to the Vancouver Sun newspaper in December of 1994. And it's so powerful. I actually could probably just read this and sit down and it would be all over. He says, "My name is Teague. I'm 11 years old and have really severe cerebral palsy. The Latimer case in Saskatchewan has caused me a great deal of unhappiness and worry over the past few weeks. I feel very strong that all children are valuable and deserve to live full and complete lives. No one should make the decision for another person on whether their life is worth living or not. I have a friend who had cerebral palsy, and he decided that life was too hard and too painful, so he really let himself die. I knew he was leaving this world and letting himself dwell in the spiritual world. I told him that I understood that the spiritual world was really compelling, but that life was worth fighting for. I had to fight to live when I was very sick. The doctor said I wouldn't live long, but I knew I had so much to accomplish still. I have to fight pain all the time. When I was little, life was pain. I couldn't remember no pain. My foster mom, Cara, helped me to learn to manage and control my pain. Now my life is so full of joy. There isn't time enough in the day for me to learn and experience all I wish to. I have a family and many friends who love me. I have a world of knowledge to discover. I have so much to give. I can't walk or talk or feed myself, but I am not suffering from cerebral palsy. I use a wheelchair, but I am not confined to a wheelchair. I have pain, but I do not need to be put out of my misery. My body is not my enemy. It is that which allows me to enjoy Mozart, experience Shakespeare, savor a bouillabaisse feast, and cuddle my mom. Life is a precious gift. It belongs to the person to whom it was given, not to her parents nor to the state. Tracy's life was hers to make of it what she could. My life is going to be astounding." And he died about 6 months after that. But boy, didn't he say it all for 11 years old? I thought that was amazing. In 95, the Senate issues its report after investigating the issue, and they recommend maintaining both euthanasia and assisted suicide as criminal offenses because of the danger posed to society, and they also recommend a greater emphasis on palliative care. And then we go to Nancy Morrison in 96. She's a Halifax respirologist. She disconnects a respirator from Paul Mills, who was dying of lung cancer. And when he doesn't die spontaneously and is very distressed, she tries several different things and then finally injects potassium chloride and he dies. She is then arrested in 97, but the case is dismissed because it's not possible to determine if he was actually going to die anyway because he was in such a terminal phase of his life, or if it was the potassium chloride that killed him. Potassium chloride is never used to relieve pain, and physicians are urged to seek help in caring for palliative patients. And the ongoing public discussion is also advised, and this was in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. This case brings up the importance of intent. We often give large doses of opiate medications with the intent to relieve pain. It's not the intent to kill. Now, euthanasia advocates really like to say, well, that's just talk, because the person's just as dead, whatever you do. And I like to use this example. Say I tell you that I ran over a child on my front street 2 days ago and killed him. What's my punishment? You can't tell me, because it's very different if a child runs out in front of my car, I'm not impaired, I'm not speeding, any of those things, he's chasing a ball, he runs out, I have no chance, and I kill him. I carry that for the rest of my life that I've killed a child, but I'm not even charged. If, however, I'm impaired, I'm speeding, my car doesn't have brakes, any of those kinds of things, I should have been, I'm talking on my cell phone, I should have seen him, then there is some penalty to me. However, if I'm waiting around the corner because I can't stand the little brat and he comes out and I run around there and I run him down on purpose, that's murder and it's premeditated. And I should be tried for murder and convicted. So he's just as dead either way. But our law is very clear that intent is an incredibly important thing in our culture, and we forget that at our peril. Okay, I'm going to skip the summaries because you know that. There are also several jurisdictions in the world that have legalized at least some form of assisted death. Australia did it for a short time, but they don't have it now. So there's euthanasia and assisted suicide in the Netherlands and Belgium, only assisted suicide in Switzerland and Oregon. Okay, even with the so-called safeguards that the Dutch have put in place, they killed a ballet dancer in her 20s when she asked to be euthanized because she had arthritis in her toes and she could no longer dance. The Remmelink report, which is the report of the Dutch government's own findings, showed that a third of those who were euthanized without their explicit consent, which was over 1,000 people in a small country in Holland. Okay, there was Dr. Ben, okay, now, Alex, where are you? How do you pronounce that in Dutch?
I'm not
going to pronounce that. Okay. Z-Y-L-C-Z. His patient was leery of, she was a cancer patient, but she wasn't immediately dying. She needed to come into the hospital for a tune-up. She said, I'm afraid if I go in, I'm going to end up dead. He said, I'm on call this weekend. I'll take care of you. He took care of her. She still needed to be in the hospital a little while longer. He went off duty, came back. She was dead. He found the doctor who was caring for her and said, what happened? You know, she wasn't dying. And he said, well, she was going to die anyway. I needed the bed. Okay? I needed the bed. There's also been a directive to Dutch physicians that has been put out that they should remember that they know how to talk to the parents of newborn disabled infants so that the parents will choose not to have them treated. Because of the burden on the child, which they're making the decision, and also the burden on society. So regardless of the conclusion, every report and article stresses the necessity of sober discussion, which is why we're coming early to talk about this, because you need time to get your head around these issues, and more emphasis on palliative care. Okay, what is palliative care? Palliative care is serving to alleviate without curing. And it comes from a Latin word, pallium, which is the cloak, the outer cloak that was put over the clothing in Roman times. That was the pallium. So it's the idea of covering. Okay. This is the World Health Organization definition. I will read it just so we've got it on the tape. Palliative care is the active total care of patients whose disease is not responsive to curative treatment. Control of pain, of other symptoms, and of psychological, social, and spiritual problems is paramount. The goal of palliative care is the achievement of the best possible quality of life for the patient and families. This name was first applied to specialized care for dying patients in 1967 by Dame Cecily Saunders. She died in St. Christopher's Hospice a year ago this past summer. And she founded St. Christopher's, which is the first modern hospice outside London in a residential suburb. And she brought scientific medicine to the world of the care for the dying. And she is just an amazing person. And the reason that they didn't just call it hospice medicine was because in, and Pierre, you can tell me about this, but in French, the word hospice has the connotation of being like a Salvation Army hospice and for lubby-dub sort of folks. So this is one of those areas where they went into palliative care so that people who had French as their native language would not feel as though they were going someplace that was, you know, for down and outers. Okay. It comes from the same, hospice comes from the same linguistic root as hospitality. And it's traced back to medieval times where hospices were formed to care for weary or ill travelers. And many of these travelers were coming back from the Crusades and they were dying. They had leprosy, tuberculosis, you name it, they had it with not any modern medicine. So they often were places for the dying. The treatment of total pain is standardized through Dr. Saunders' work, and she developed this term, total pain. And it means that there are these four different things. Now, actually, the picture doesn't really look like this. I'm not very good with my computer, so it should be all overlapping and Venn diagram kind of stuff, but this is the best I could do. It's a pie chart. So there are physical, psychological, social, and spiritual elements to pain. And I'd like to just give you an example of a patient that we cared for in Halifax where all of these elements overlapped. We had a young woman who had cancer of the cervix, and she was convinced that the reason that she had cancer of the cervix and all the pain that was associated with it in her case was because God had cursed her because she had had a promiscuous lifestyle. So despite all the pain medication we could give her, we still couldn't get her pain under control. So we had the folks from the chaplain from her faith come and speak to her, and she actually confessed what she was experiencing. She talked with him a long time. She felt forgiven from this, and she had a 80% reduction in the amount of pain that she had. It was just amazing with the same pain medication after the spiritual pain was relieved. But there was still something going on, and I said to her, "What is it? We can't get your pain controlled. There's something else going." And she said to me, "Do you really want to know?" And I said, "Yes, I really want to know." And she said, "I'm just worried that when I die, no one is going to be able to cash in my Club Z points." And I looked at her and I said, you know, we teach this technique about repeat the last thing the person said. And I said, "Your Club Z points?" And she said, "Yes, I have a 5-year-old son, and I've been saving for 2 years to get him a bicycle, and I don't want them to go to waste." Well, we can't always fix things in palliative care, but that we could fix. We got her Club Z card, we got money from the foundation, we went down and paid off the bicycle, and the child had the bicycle very soon. Then her pain was 100% controlled. So all of those issues were coming to bear. Now, what was the kind, compassionate, altruistic thing to do for this woman? Was it just to have her say, when she's suffering so much that she can't stand it anymore, that, fine, let's just get rid of you? Or to find out what's at the root of her suffering, come alongside her and help her to overcome it, and to actually grow in the midst of her dying? Recent studies about quality of life are quite interesting. It's a very difficult thing to measure because most of the indices have a whole lot of health issues in there, so you automatically fail in quality of life if your health isn't good. This new one, the CQOLDW, and I can't remember what it all stands for, and the internet was down where I'm staying, so I couldn't look it up again. Anyway, the patient, it'll be on the little paper that we put around. The patient chooses his own domain. So he says, here's the 5 things that are most important to me. And when they studied it, they found that 100% of the people choose their family in some form as one of the domains. And then, but only about half ranked health as even entering into the picture. And then you assign a degree of difficulty. So my family's on there, and it makes up, say, 40% of my quality of life index. And maybe the next thing is it might be my health or how I'm feeling, or another would be my job or whatever, things like that that are there. And the patient is allowed to choose those, and as time goes along, to choose other ones if something else has become more important in the patient's quality of life. And the interesting thing, the thing called the Kalman gap that's there, is the expectations are at one level and reality is at another level, and what's in between is the Kalman gap. And the people that have the highest Kalman gap have the biggest chance for the low quality of life and depression and other things. Well, the people that have that tend to be young business executives, actually. And people in palliative care settings have a smaller Kalman gap. And when they used this CQOLDW to check on quality of life, they actually found that the Kalman gap got smaller as people got closer to death, because they realized what was more important in their lives. It was quite interesting, which means that their quality of life improved instead of decreasing. And besides, who decides? Okay. Also, Harvey Chachanov from the University of Manitoba, who's a real treasure for us here in Canada, he published a study in The Lancet, which is a very prestigious journal in Britain, of 168 palliative patients, and he had them rate what their will to live was. And in a 12-hour period, they rated it twice, there was 33-point variation on a scale of 100. That's the average variation. So from the morning till the evening, it's 33% change in what my will to live is. Over a 24-hour period, it went up to 35, almost 36. And over a 7-day period, it was almost half. So this idea that you can have an enduring request is put to the lie in this literature. And he said these large fluctuations suggest that will to live is highly unstable. So how are we going to use an enduring request when the will to live is unstable? He also did a study on dignity, and there were 3 major factors that were there. Physical symptoms. So when people first come into the hospital and they're just feeling wretched, before they often will express, oh, just let me go, until we've got them organized. One of the times I was recently in Ottawa, I got the Norwalk virus. And let me tell you, I kind of felt that way myself at one point. But then, you know, now looking back on it, you think, whoa, what was I thinking? You know, because it's just, you're just feeling so awful. So physical symptoms are important. Socially mediated influences like privacy, respect, perceptions of how we are seen. And who's responsible for that? It's not the patient, it's the rest of us that are responsible for those things. How the person is seen. We're responsible for that. Psychological and spiritual makeup of the person. And he says, dignity is hard to measure. It's in the eye of the beholder. And when young, healthy people are making a decision about disabled people or older people, that, you know, we need to be real careful about deciding. Like my husband, who's also a physician, says, we need to be careful about this because the number one thing in healthcare resources is that dead people don't use resources. Okay, and so if young, healthy people are making the decisions for the rest of us, we have to be careful. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is the woman who came up with the phases of dying, all the different phases of dying, and she also died recently. And here's what she said about being with people who were dying. I say to people who care for people who are dying, if you really love that person and want to help them, be with them when their end comes close. Sit with them. You don't even have to talk. You don't have to do anything but really be there with them. That does not cost money. Caregiving conference I've been a part of says 90% of caring is just showing up. That's even better than your 80 for 20. There are some ways to help families. I think I'll just leave that one because we can put that on there. Lots of ways that you can help families and come alongside them. And there's some other ways that you can suggest for out-of-town members to assist the families who are right in town with the person, because oftentimes one family is bearing the burden unnecessarily. This is a list that I put together, this will be on the website too, of things that my patients and their families have taught me that are helpful for people in difficult situations. And anybody can do these things. Listening is the number one thing. Music, compiling a collection of significant music, that's a really wonderful gift for the person who's dying and wonderful for the family afterward, especially if you find out why those things were important to the person. It's really a wonderful legacy to have. Choosing a video, buying and wrapping presents, visiting the patient to relieve the caregiver, having all these different things, having bringing meals, being a telephone or email headquarters. I'm going to skip the next one. I guess I'll talk about it now. Setting up a sign-up sheet or a book. One family did this. They got really tired of people saying, oh, if there's ever anything I can do, and then realizing that they would never call them. So they wrote down all the stuff they needed help with, and they said, if you're serious, sign up for something, which was great. And they said, we knew that people didn't all mean it, so we put in some really face-saving things in there, like bring me a few cookies or mail some letters so that they could sign up for something that didn't cost them very much. I have refined this a little bit to say, make sure that the things that are in the book are specific and time-limited. So instead of saying, make dinner for me, say, make dinners on Tuesday night for the month of November. And then the person says, well, I'm only signing up for 4 suppers, so I can do that. And then you can renew afterward. And the other thing that's quite good is if you can get someone, a family member or a good friend, to go to the family, take the book and say, okay, what do you need? And then that same person takes the book home to friends, faith community, whatever, and says, okay, this is what they need. What are you going to sign up for? And takes responsibility for having all the blanks filled in. So that's something that's really good. And you can put on there whatever you want to. Aiding connections with their faith community, laughing and remembering together, writing things down. One woman that I cared for in Halifax got some help to go to the Burke's jewelry store. And she went there and she had 2 granddaughters, 9 and 11, and she bought them each a birthday gift right through their 21st birthday and left it at the Burke's vault for Burke's to send out to her granddaughters every year on their birthdays. So I thought that was really pretty spectacular. And this idea of adopting a child, one very small little church in Vancouver did the most spectacular thing. I took care of a young mom who was 32 years old who died of breast cancer. She had 4 children, 10 and under. And it was just heartbreaking to see. And her church was so good about suffering along with her and helping out. But Each of the children had a special friend at church. So those four families said that they would kind of adopt that child for the year. Now the children lived at home with their dad, and he cared for them through the night and did that. But for these other families, when there was a soccer team to sign up for, they signed this child up. When there was a birthday party to go to, he went. When it was time to go to McDonald's, she came along. You know, they kept a little drawer of clothing at the house. They had the pajamas and everything there for what they needed. And it gave this dad a year to grieve and to get back on his feet. And I thought that was really spectacular to do that. So there are all kinds of things we can do that are compassionate and altruistic and loving. We don't have to say, well, just go and shuffle off this mortal coil. Mother Teresa said, we cannot all do great things, but we can do small things with great love. And I say amen to that. I think it's Herbert Hendon that said this. I've been trying to find it on the internet, but every time I look on the internet for it, I just see that I quoted it. So it's not very helpful. But anyway, he said that someone said that euthanasia kills the patient twice. And if you're out there, whoever said that, hearing this, please write to me and tell me who you are, because I would really like to know. And I think it's a very good concept, because the first time we kill the patient is when we look at their life and the person is crying out to us saying, oh, I don't think my life is worth living. And we say, you're right, it's not. And then the next time is when we kill them, actually. Here's what Herbert Hendon said, and I'm almost done, you'll be glad to know. Euthanasia advocates have come to see suicide as a cure for disease and a way of appropriating death's power over the human capacity for control. This is all a control issue. They have detoured what could be a constructive effort to manage the final phase of life in more varied and individualistic ways. And I'll stop the quote there. Imagine that, think about that. We are talking about caring for people as being the individualistic thing, not the one-size-fits-all, fine, you're dying, we'll kill you. Okay, it's interesting, because we always get told that, well, you're not for individuals, whereas palliative care and caring for them is much more individualistic than just saying that we'll kill people. Okay, back to the quotation. Our social policy must be based on a larger and more positive concern for people who are terminally ill. It must reflect an expansive determination to relieve their physical pain, to discover the nature of their fears, and to diminish suffering by providing meaningful reassurance of the life that has been lived and is still going on. Helen Keller, who would have been a real candidate for euthanasia after she got meningitis as a child and could no longer see or hear, led an astounding life. And she said, although the world is full of suffering, it is also full of the overcoming of it. And isn't that what makes us human beings at a really basic level? Albert Schweitzer, in everyone's life at some time our inner fire goes out. It is then burst into flame by an encounter with another human being. We should all be thankful for those people who rekindle the inner spirit. And you know, I would have to tell you in my life that some of those people who rekindle the inner spirit for me are my palliative care patients. We had one young man named David that we cared for in Vancouver, who one of the social workers afterwards said, it was amazing. He suffered more than anybody I've ever seen physically, and yet we beat down his door to spend time with him. He was 27 when he died. He'd had cancer from the time he was 19. He took so much. I'd never written the kind of opiate doses that I wrote for this young man, because the tumor had invaded his spinal cord, and we ended up finally having to put opiates into his spinal cord in order to keep him comfortable. And yet, he was the most amazing person to care for. He was so appreciative of everything we did. He fought for every moment of his life. And it was a privilege to be part of that, to give that to him. Another little thing to think about is the family reaction when a patient has taken his own life in a palliative setting via a suicide. And this was a little survey that was done by one of my colleagues in Montreal of his own patients. And he actually is in favor of euthanasia, this colleague, in some circumstances. But this is what has given him pause, is talking to those families. Because although there was initial relief and acceptance of what the person did, and saying, well, that was really what he wanted, etc., that as time went on, there was a delayed disappointment with themselves, not with the patient. because they see other families where grandpa wanted to live to the very end of his life, or grandma wanted to see the new grandchild born, or to come to a wedding, or whatever. And they begin to say, if those people wanted to live to the end of their natural life, what was wrong with us that we could not provide that for our loved one? And I would like to put it to you that there are lessons for us to learn as a culture. I spoke before the Senate Committee in 1995, and this is what I said to them, that as a culture, we need to learn that lesson, that what are we going to feel about ourselves? What is our identity going to be if we do not protect the most weak and the most vulnerable among us? What is it going to feel like 50 years from now if all the Terri Schiavos that are among us are starved to death? What are we going to think about ourselves? What kind of a nation, what kind of a culture, what kind of a society are we going to be? And if we want to preserve compassion and altruism as the basis for a society, there has to be strong support for palliative care as the best way to do this, not just the easy acceptance of an assisted death. Edmund Pellegrino said, he's a very famous, world-famous physician and ethicist, bioethicist. In fact, he headed up the President's Commission on Bioethics in the United States. He said, pleas for assistance in suicide are in reality desperate pleas for help, including emotional and spiritual support. They should therefore be met with comprehensive, intensive palliative care, not the accelerated demise of the person suffering. And that's all that I have to say today. Thank you.